Last week, we covered a serial killer who went as far as changing their gender to escape prosecution, which we know failed. So this week, I'm going to tell you a story of a straight-up dickhead who left to start an entirely new life after murdering his entire family. And the Worst Father Ever award will officially go to Dickhead Christian Longo. What's up, guys? It's your girl Ginger, the true crime queen. I'm reminding you now that listener discretion is advised. The dark nature of this show is not suitable for your little ears or those who are sensitive to graphic material. But without further ado, let's get it. So welcome back, my loves. This week, we are talking about another dark case out of beautiful Oregon State. It's unfortunate that so many things happen in such a nice place, but that only goes to show that shit like this can happen to anyone at any time in any place. This case will include some heavy parts, including the death of three children, and I promise I won't make it cringy, and I will leave it as vague as possible. Really, the details aren't very necessary in this one, but I'm going to give you a heads up anyways. If you're not familiar with the case at all, we are talking about a father who basically killed his entire family while in the state of Oregon and then flees to Mexico. It's a crazy ride from almost start to finish, so you'll be able to watch the downfall as we go along. Our story starts in Michigan and actually moves west to Oregon and eventually to Mexico. And from all outward appearances, the father of this family would seem charming and hardworking and handsome. Not to me, of course. From the people who really knew him, though, he was lying and cheating, and he was a snake. And time after time, Christian Longo will seemingly get himself out of a lot of little things. But don't let him fool you, he's one of the most manipulating people that I've covered so far. Christian Longo was born on January 23rd in 1974 in Ypsilanti Township, Michigan. He was said to have grown up in a strict family of Jehovah's Witnesses, and this would actually be how he met his future wife, Mary Jane Baker. And they met in the parking lot just outside their local congregation, as Mary Jane was also raised as a devout Jehovah's Witness. I think the money problem started even before their marriage, but I only say that because Christian actually has said that he purchased Mary Jane a 3.5-carat engagement ring, which he literally had no realistic way of affording. He admits that at one point prior to the wedding, their rent and the bill for the ring was due, and he decided to steal $108 from the till of the register at a camera store he was working at during the time. He says his conscience got the better of him, though, and he returned the money the next morning with his letter of resignation, and the rent ended up being late that month. And being that Christian and Mary Jane were both still Jehovah's Witnesses, somehow the church elders found out about Christian's little stint with the camera store, and they were no longer allowed to use the Kingdom Hall as their wedding venue. Now imagine, your husband gets banned from the place you're planning your wedding. Not that it's like the biggest deal, but I'm sure Mary Jane felt super embarrassed. And Christian, however, repented with the church for his sins, and he made a vow to stay honest, and 25-year-old Mary Jane Baker continued to plan her wedding with 19-year-old Christian Longo in the early 1990s. At first, Christian seemed like the perfect husband, according to Mary Jane's sister, and he had always made the other wives envious of how much he seemed to charm Mary Jane. And Christian decided he's going to start up his own business, actually, called Final Touch, which was said to be a cleaning company for contractual work. And he persuades both their families that business is booming, and even convincing Mary Jane's father to invest tens of thousands of dollars into Christian's business. And Christian and Mary Jane went to go on and grow their family to five, one right literally after the other, starting in 1997 with Zachary, 1998 with Sadie, and 1999 with baby Madison. It wasn't long after her father's investments that Christian brought home a boat that he claims to have won, and it was hauling two brand new jet skis on the back. Christian and Mary Jane would end up driving new cars, they would go on expensive vacations, having all kinds of new clothes, and they're exponentially increasing their debt. Money got so tight at one point, their brand new Ford Taurus was actually repossessed from outside their home, while the other car reportedly broke down, and it forced Christian to use public transportation for work, as Mary Jane had quit working to raise the children at home. Ain't no way in hell Christian Longo will be seen riding a bus, though, because this motherfucker actually takes the time and effort to produce himself a fake ID which he then uses to test drive a new minivan that he has no intentions of ever returning. Yeah, I'm not kidding. Not only that, but when Mary Jane started getting curious about the bill that wasn't coming for their new car, he fucking made one and he kept sending them to the house to trick her. If a man like this can put so much effort into these petty ass things, I'm curious as to why he wasn't able to function at a regular ass job or even at a harder job. It's really weird with logic, if you ask me. In May of 2000, Mary Jane reportedly contacted her sister to spill the tea that she had discovered some shady ass emails inside of Christian's account. She explains that he's cheated on her and is, or still is, and when she actually confronts him about it, he explains that she's, quote, no fun anymore after having the kids and doesn't pay any attention to him anymore. So he gaslit her and she actually ended up staying with him, but luckily she told the church and he was once again sanctioned, which is to have certain privileges revoked in the church as a disciplinary method they use. It also turns out that Christian had been forging some pretty big checks through his cleaning company where he would cash the fake checks of his clients that he had produced. And in September of 2000, Christian actually had to go to court over it. He pled guilty and explained his motive was being financially strapped, so they actually went pretty lenient on him with just probation and a bit of restitution fines, and you'd think that that would help a guy out, but this guy is so narcissistic that he even exaggerated the money that he does make, forcing even the restitution payments to be much more than he can realistically afford. So he's literally drowning in debt at this point. Then, when the elders of the church read about Christian's forgery charges in their local newspaper, they finally kick his ass out altogether, which is also being called disfellowshipped. And when that happens to someone in the church, you are not allowed to interact with them anymore. If your husband is disfellowshipped and you are not, then you cannot be seen interacting in public with him. But you do have to be obedient to him, or so my grandma explained to me, who was also in the church for a while until they realized how intense it is, and then my grandparents pieced the fuck out. But this is all so fucked to me because here he did all these shitty ass things, including cheating on his wife, and it's literally some forgery charges that was the last straw to the church. I mean, logic. Mary Jane actually sticks with his ass and also leaves the church, and Christian and her decide that they will gift each other something they've both been wanting, and then they will finally become responsible adults and start paying their bills. Laser eye surgery for Mary Jane, and Christian said he wanted to take some scuba diving lessons, and so they leave Michigan as a family, and they set off to their new home that Christian had found for them. But this was actually not a house, it was a fucking warehouse in Toledo, Ohio, with no bathroom, no kitchen, and no bedroom. Christian says his intentions were to remodel the warehouse and turn it into a somewhat townhouse-style open home, which obviously never happened. Instead, he started stealing machinery and then trying to resell it on the black market, and when he caught wind that the police were onto him, he forced Mary Jane and the kids to leave the warehouse home in what appears to be a hurry. Many items and keepsakes were found to have been abandoned by a seeming, as the family just seems to have up and vanished, and the fact that Christian even left the state of Michigan means he totally violated his probation for the slap of the wrist that he received 2 months prior. Mary Jane's own sister then went and filed a missing persons report not long after they were discovered to have moved to Ohio because she was unable to actually talk with her sister as it seems that the cell phone bill never got paid before they skipped town in the stolen minivan, still unbeknownst to Mary, and another stolen moving truck that Christian managed to swindle. It was reported that many of the family's keepsakes and family photos were also found discarded along the path that they drove towards the West Coast. Christian even says that he actually stopped somewhere along the way and ended up pawning the engagement ring that had started the debt snowball and only got a few $100 for it. In early November of 2001, the sister of Mary Jane had finally received some sign that Mary Jane was at least alive when she was sent a postcard from Mary Jane postmarked from the state of South Dakota. At this point, the missing persons report was dismissed and the police are no longer trying to get in contact, but that was the last form of communication that they would ever have with her. And unbeknownst to her, the Longo family would settle in a Oregon State coastal town where Christian would take up a part-time job as a barista at Starbucks within a Fred Meyer grocery store. Longo had somehow managed to get the family into these luxury waterfront condos without having to put any money down as he allegedly gave the owners some type of sob story, which as always somehow worked for this douchebag. So they had a place, he was making like $7.40 an hour part-time with a $1,500 rent tag and a giant pile of burning debt and restitution, as well as a family of five to support. And can you imagine his anxiety? And even more so when you remember that Mary Jane is not exactly aware of how bad their financial situation truly is. And trigger warning, it was just a week before Christmas when a man staying at an RV camp noticed the body of a small child floating face down in the Alsea River near his site. Noticing the boy was a well-cared-for child with no signs of abuse, police assumed this was a tragic accident and immediately rushed to digitally enhance a photo to put out on the news in hopes of someone being able to tell the police who this child is. And a woman who actually worked with Christian at the Fred Meyer Starbucks, who actually babysat a couple times for the Longos, immediately recognizes Zachary and comes forward to identify him after no one else was found. And she indicated that he is from a local family in the area. Police then fear there may have been some sort of horrible car accident that they aren't aware of and that the rest of the family might still be out in the water, so they continue to search the water in which 4-year-old Zachary's body was found. Here's another trigger warning for you. 3 days after Zach's body was found, on December 22nd of 2001, the body of his little 3-year-old sister, Sadie, was also found, and it seems as though she was weighed down in the water by a pillowcase filled with rocks that was tied to her ankle. And the one that was on Zach's had just slipped off, allowing his body to rise to the surface, which obviously points more towards a homicide and not just a tragic accident. On December 27th of 2001, after finding evidence that indicates the children were possibly killed and not the victims of some sort of mishappening, they begin searching all the nearby waterways, where they end up locating two suspicious-looking suitcases stuck below a marina dock just outside the condominiums that the Longos had recently been staying in. Trigger warning. One suitcase contained the body of 2-year-old baby Madison, while the other held the body of 38-year-old Mary Jane. Logically, because most moms do not zip themselves up into suitcases and hop into the water on their own, police have a major interest in finding who appears to be the only remaining person in this family, Christian. And he had apparently picked up his last paycheck from work on the same day that Zachary's body was found before it hit the news. And Christian had told his coworkers that they likely wouldn't see his family any longer as Mary Jane had decided to take the kids and leave him for another man. So Longo makes the FBI's most wanted list for multiple murder charges as well as unlawful flight. Christian had decided to continue heading south, making a stop in San Francisco and actually applying for another job at a Starbucks, interestingly using the name of his former manager back in Oregon, though instead of posting up, he continued south towards Mexico. Now, January 7th of 2002, Longo makes it to Cancun, Mexico, and he was actually noticed by another international traveler who had recognized him from his wanted pictures after she had returned home from Mexico. He was then reported to the FBI as being seen by a tour guide who also recognized him from his recently posted wanted pictures in the area. And he was seen hanging out with other younger tourists, snorkeling and traveling from hostel to hostel, all while telling the people that he was with that he was a writer with the New York Times named Michael Finkel and he was in the area on assignment. And this Michael Finkel happened to be an actual prize-winning writer for the New York Times that Christian rather admired as an author. So while smoking weed in a shanty with a young German tourist he was already sleeping with, Longo was then cock-blocked by nearly 20 Mexican federales along with a U.S. federal agent named Daniel Clegg about 80 miles south or 131 kilometers south of Cancun in a small city known as Tulum. Christian was then taken into the United States federal custody when he landed back into the George Bush International Airport in Houston, Texas on January 14th of 2002, not even a month after his family was murdered. And medical examiners determined that all four family members likely died from asphyxia, though Mary Jane also was found to have some evidence of blunt force trauma on her face. There was actually some dispute on this during the trial between the prosecution and the defense, though. Christian's defense team had requested a change of venue for the trial, citing the community sentiment of Lincoln County, where the bodies were, would create an unfair trial, but was denied because a good enough case wasn't made to move it. The judge basically reasoned that a crime of this magnitude would taint all the surrounding areas alike, based on all the media coverage and his manhunt. So it turns out that the reporters would also be contacting Michael Finkel for his take on the man who killed his family and fled to Mexico claiming to be him. Interestingly though, Michael Finkel was totally blindsided by that news because he had been in the middle of his own shitstorm after being fired from the New York Times for fabricating the story that they published. So Michael and Christian actually begin corresponding and even meet while in prison as Christian is awaiting his trial. Michael agrees to teach Christian to write if Christian tells Michael what really happened, so they can write a book together in the future. And when facing the death penalty, Christian decided to try one more time to con his way out of the deepest hole he'd ever been in. So before the trial had even really officially started, Christian decided to throw the court for a loop and only pled guilty to the murders of Mary Jane and baby Madison. And he simply refused to plead anything for the murders of Zachary and Sadie, so the court pled not guilty to those two specifically on his behalf. The prosecution in the case believed Christian had planned the murders out for months prior to them even occurring, and his family had simply become too much of a hassle for him to deal with, citing evidence that he had previously visited a website in relation to a hitman or information on getting away with murder. They also found notes that he was clearly trying to make a future attempt of a new identity from obituary clippings that were found. Prosecutors go on to show how Christian had separated his wife and family from everyone in their lives, even attempting to throw extended family off suspicion by sending a postcard specifically from South Dakota. The state was able to produce a couple witnesses, even, that reported hearing unusual sounds of dragging to the management of the condominium in the days before Zachary's body was discovered in the nearby waterfront. Their most important witness, though, was a truck driver named Dick Hawk that was able to identify Christian Longo as a man that he had seen on a narrow bridge named the Lint Slow Bridge with a red minivan in the early morning hours in the days before the family would be found. Lastly, Agent Clegg told prosecutors that while on the flight back to Oregon from Mexico, Christian had said, "I sent them to a better place," but that's all that Christian would say about them, basically insinuating some sort of a confession. Christian's own attorneys argued that the same Agent Clegg had failed to properly inform Longo of his right to counsel even while in Mexico, being that if Longo would have understood he did not have to return to the United States, that Mexico would likely not extradite him as he might be sentenced to death. They said that instead, Clegg told Longo that if he didn't return with him willingly, he would likely sit in a Mexican prison for months awaiting his trial. And that's the only reason Longo signed a waiver of his rights just prior to boarding the plane that would take him back to American soil, and that he only ever learned that Oregon State still allows capital punishment while on his second flight from Houston back to Oregon. They also downplayed the neighbors' complaints of the dragging sounds to being that some wild Christmas party somewhere else in the building, not Christian's condo. And they point out to jurors and that the only real evidence that the state has on Christian for the murders of Zachary and Sadie are the witness accounts that he was seen on the bridge super late at night by some local truck driver. They also claimed that the manner in which the police had Dick identify Christian as the man he had seen was questionable, throwing doubt into the aspect that Christian was telling truth about only murdering Madison and his wife, Mary Jane. They also disputed that Zachary and Sadie died of drowning and not asphyxia and did not die in the same manner or location as Mary Jane and Madison, making it very possible that they were killed by the other parent. Now, Christian sat on the stand for 2 days before getting to the subject of the actual murders themselves, as he told this whole tale of debt accumulation and constant repenting with the church. But when he did finally get to what everyone was waiting for, he explained that he and Mary Jane had planned a little date on the evening of December 15th, and that's when she actually confronted him on all the lying and shady shit that he's done, and he decided at that moment that it's not the best time to inform her that they literally only had days left in their condo as they were not going to be able to pay the rent. So he waits. He goes to work on December 16th, returns from work, and then ponders telling Mary Jane again about the situation over some wine and cheese, but again chickened out and instead tried to go to sleep. When he couldn't sleep, though, it's when he finally comes clean about everything. The stolen car, the unpaid rent, it all. Everything. And they have, like, this total breakdown. She rages at him for 45 minutes straight, and they end up sleeping in separate rooms. The next morning, he wakes up, and she drives him to work, and he kisses his children goodbye. Later, when she picked him up after work, she was waiting on the passenger side of the car in the parking lot. He said she was only wearing a robe and not even shoes or slippers or anything, but she was just barefoot and that the kids were not with her. He says she completely ignored him the whole drive home and she did not want to enter the condo, so he had to, like, physically carry her in. When they finally get inside, she starts crying and whimpering on the floor by the door, and that's when he runs through the home to find a lifeless Madison on the bed but no sign of Zachary or Sadie. Trigger warning. He then returns to Mary Jane by the door and begins violently shaking her, demanding an answer for what had happened to the children. She then starts getting upset and tells him that it's your fault, you're the one that killed us, and that the other kids were in the water. He says that is when he snapped. He lifted her up by her throat and began strangling her. He dropped her once, picked her back up, and held her by the neck until he physically couldn't hold her up anymore. He says he then decided to put them into suitcases, but as he was gathering up his baby Madison, he noticed she was still breathing. And he said on the stand, "Since I already thought of her as dead, I just finished her off by holding her throat until I couldn't feel her breathing anymore." He then placed her inside one of the suitcases, but added some clothes to it so as to not be so roomy for his small little body. But then he cares not to include the fact that he added a dumbbell to it to weigh it down in the water. And just a heads up, another trigger warning. The prosecutors tried to call bullshit on Christian about Mary Jane even being physically able to lift the two children up and over a bridge rail with heavy rocks added to the weight, being that she was only 110 pounds herself and also had no previous history of violence or an angry temper. But I don't know how big these rocks were, and I don't want to split hairs, but I'm about the same size, and a four-year-old is really not that big. I mean, I think it could be done, but not that she did it, and I'm just saying. The jurors would have to decide if Christian was guilty of all four murders or not, and one juror supposedly said, "At first, I thought the prosecution had made a mistake about his charming young man, but it was Longo's own testimony that had did himself in." After a four-hour deliberation, jurors would come back with all four counts of aggravated murder on April 7th of 2003. The same jury would now have to decide if he would be sentenced to death. During the penalty phase of the trial, and before determining what Christian would be sentenced with, the prosecution wanted jurors to know that Christian had actually committed several infractions while being incarcerated already, one of them being that he attempted to escape with the help of a fellow inmate and chipping a hole into his cell window. His defense attorneys claimed that it was just an exaggeration and that he was simply just trying to look outside and brushed off the infractions he had received to be like little common issues and no big deal at all. They also went on to justify that he shouldn't receive the death penalty, being that his biological father was a drunk alcoholic who abused his mother and also Christian as a small boy. So basically, asked the jurors to be lenient with him. They think he really has been good in general since he's been in custody. But after 6 hours of deliberation on capital punishment, the jury decides Christian Longo should be sentenced to the fullest extent of the law on April 16th of 2003. And the jurors also all agreed to look Christian in his eyes as the verdict was being announced, so as to show that he did not fool a single one of them with his version of the story. In the months following the trial, Christian actually wrote a couple letters, specifically to Michael Finkel and another to Mary Jane's sister Sally, which is described as another near confession, but also included alleged details of how Zachary and Sadie were killed. However, Christian has since then retracted back to his original story he told in court for his appeals process, even though he was been quoted in saying, "I condemn my acts from what I did in the past, and I no longer disassociate myself from those acts. It's something I did solely." Michael Finkel did eventually publish a book about his experience meeting with the man who claimed to be him after murdering his family and fleeing to Mexico, and he titled it True Story, Murder, Memoir, Mea Culpa. And details what Christian told him about the murders, but more so how Christian Longo just used him to tell a better story to the jury, sort of like, quote, a dress rehearsal of sorts. And 8 years into death row, and Christian Longo again gets the break of a literal lifetime when the state of Oregon decides to put a moratorium on capital punishment and converts all death row sentences to life terms without parole instead. Christian makes headlines twice in 1 year in 2011, this time for applying for marriage, actually. While Mary Jane is dead and gone, Christian wants to be in love again. But fuck that noise, because it was denied, and specifically because he applied to marry another former prison inmate who are actually not allowed back into the prison for visitation. So poor boy Christian is going to have to die alone. Or at least unmarried. Which is only fair, since he murdered his entire family. But 10 years following one of Oregon's darkest crimes, this histrionic asshole has the audacity to write the media directly about how he's come to terms with his narcissistic personality disorder and how he'd like to help by donating his organs like Will Smith did in the movie 7 Pounds. I am not making this shit up, you guys. It was reported that Christian authored his own book about his proposal that death row inmates' organs should be used in donation programs for those in need. And it's titled, The Forsaken Gift of Life, an expose on the pointless ban on prisoner organ donation, which is an utter and complete joke. The forsaken gift of life? What a fucking asshole, dude. What about your forsaken children whom you gave the gift of life, yet murdered? Nope. No, 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 no. Abso-fucking-lutely not. Get the fuck out of here, Christian. No. So in April 2015, Michael Finkel's book actually got made into a movie adaptation. And I spent $3.99 or something and actually rented the movie on Amazon Prime for shits and giggles, and it's not a bad watch, honestly. It's called True Story, and it only really dips into the relationship between Christian and Michael Finkel during the time between his arrest and his trial. But what's the coolest part about that is that James Franco actually plays Christian Longo and Jonah Hill plays Michael Finkel. And I love them in this like non-comedic role, to be honest. I love them as comedians, but I also love them in like true crime stuff. It's awesome. Honestly, though, it's not a great like biographical movie about either one of them, really just Michael Finkel's experience and like account of getting dragged into like the weirdest situation of all time. And I recently did a live stream on the topic of family annihilators, which just happened to line up directly with how I scheduled out this particular episode. So it was purely luck, and honestly, it was really helpful in wrapping my mind around the mentality of someone who quite literally annihilates their entire family. So basically, there's always a few key factors in these cases, depending on which subcategory of family annihilator one will fall into. There's the less common type where one has a psychotic break or a mental health issue. But there's also the types who see their family as a symbol of economic wealth or failure. And another where there is an impending intolerance of family, like a divorce or something like that. And criminals like these often try to commit suicide or eventually confess. Take Chris Watts, for instance, who also murdered his wife and children, but then later confessed. Christian also confessed and is too narcissistic to commit suicide. Honestly, it's just a very interesting subject, especially when you throw in the factor of religion, and especially a religion like being a Jehovah's Witness. Christian also throws in this male ego identity in there, and then it's just a shit show, to be honest. So also check out my live streams on Facebook if you haven't yet. I like to cover interesting topics like this every week, and we can chat at the same time. And it just so happens that as I was writing up the script for the episode, an article actually surfaces in The Oregonian that reports Christian Longo is actually going to be moved into the general population within the Oregon State Penitentiary, as they are making room for a new disciplinary unit in the state's only maximum security prison. So maybe we can just leave it to the general population to take care of justice for us, or maybe COVID will get his ass, but I'll tell you what, I have a real distaste for Christian Longo, and I don't know what Jehovah's Witnesses believe exactly, but I hope he fears going to hell. But also, really hope he has some really annoying physical issues like never-ending hemorrhoids or super painful ingrown toenails or something. Fuck that guy. And I have a quick shout out to do though for Autism Mom 33 for your 5-star Apple Podcast review. Girl, thank you so much. It helps my podcast get more popular the more reviews I get. So seriously, thank you. And I will absolutely keep the different episodes coming. I really enjoy telling you guys these stories. And so far, hosting this podcast has been really great and really positive. So please, if you have also been enjoying the show, leave an honest review at Apple and I'll shout your ass out, okay? And just a heads up, as I get closer to episode 20, I will be taking a little season break again to spend some time with the kiddos and do something fun with them as they've been cooped up for so long. I'll continue to updates on the season break, so hopefully not everyone is shocked when I don't drop an episode for a few weeks. And I will be back next week with an update on the circumstances of Tylee Ryan and JJ Vallo, as there's been a lot of motion there, actually. So a big update on that situation. And as always, my loves, be safe, lock your doors, have a great week, everyone. And that was the tea. I hope you enjoyed my rendition of the story, and if so, please tell all your creepy friends about it. You can find the sources I used for the episode in its description. You can find me slinging those memes on Instagram at True Crime Queen. Check them out if you need a laugh after all that dark shit. If you'd like to support the podcast, consider buying me a coffee so I can keep making that killer ass content. You see what I did there? All right. Bye.